This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Don Beeler, Assistant Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her research interests include historical geography, the environmental history of public health in U.S. cities, environmental justice, urban and feminist political ecology, housing, and human-animal interactions. Dawn Beeler is here today to tell us about her book, Pests in the City, Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats, published in 2013. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Pests in the City?
I've always had a fascination with things that other people find disgusting, but at the same time, I am very concerned about social justice. And I knew that people were living in housing conditions that were unacceptable to others, and also that these insects and rodents that people live with connect neighboring homes to one another. They create kind of an ecology within cities and within apartment buildings. And I was interested in the ways in which a home could become an ecosystem.
Why did you choose flies, cockroaches, bedbugs, and rats as the focus of your book?
Well, I was interested in the ways that people interact very intimately with these animals. They don't just come in and leave. They kind of come in and stay with us and form these relationships, however disgusting the relationships may be. And these had been the targets of very prominent public health campaigns starting in the early 20th century. So I looked for evidence of those public health campaigns and found a lot of things about these four pests. There have been campaigns against mosquitoes as well, but I think mosquitoes don't have the same kind of intimacy with the home the way these four creatures do.
What are the health implications of the pests that you chose to speak about in your book?
Starting with flies, back in the early 20th century, people believed that flies could carry a whole range of diseases that we now think they're carried in our water, but at that time we thought they were carried by flies. They're diseases that are carried in people's digestive systems. They come out with people's bowel movements and then are carried by flies. And at a time when cities were populated by horses and we didn't have flush toilets in many neighborhoods, flies grew up in horse manure, flitted over to privies and these outdoor toilets, picked up infectious diseases and carried them into people's homes. We don't see that as much of a problem these days because we don't have manure coating our cities, but in those days, the flies were much more prevalent. In terms of bed bugs, we believed in the 1930s that they might be carriers of infectious diseases, but much more than that, they were a source of stress. And people who lived with these bed bugs would become sleepless because they would be attacked during the night by bed bugs and bitten. The bites were extremely itchy and would trouble them day and night. And children could be bitten so much that they would become anemic. With cockroaches are associated, again, with some of the filth that flies are, but they also foul our food. And if you live with enough of them, their crushed feces and their crushed bodies can become an allergen. The kind of proteins, the substances that are found in those crushed cockroach bodies enter the air and we breathe them in, and children especially are vulnerable to allergies and asthma as a result of that. And finally, with rats, they carry a whole range of infectious diseases that they can spread through their bites or through their urine. And when people lived with them in these very intimate situations, many of them received rat bites. As of the 1960s, at least 14,000 people were bitten each year by rats in the United States, most of them in cities, and most of them being children.
What conditions allowed the pest you speak about in your book to spread at the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, in the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of it had to do with, as I said, the fact that our cities relied on horsepower, so we had a lot of rich breeding medium for these houseflies to grow up, and then we also had outdoor privies that were another rich medium for them to grow up and also pick up these wastes. Housing conditions were also a big part of it. Housing codes were kind of gradually adopted and gradually upgraded throughout the early 20th century. Those are some of the kind of legal and physical environment issues that were involved, but there's a whole set of issues around social discrimination and racism that were also important. So racial discrimination in residential neighborhoods created a two-tiered housing market in which landlords who were willing to rent to African Americans basically had license to let those homes degrade over time. So that, as one African American sociologist put it in the 1930s, African Americans would only occupy homes at their very last stage of existence, when they had already decayed so much that a landlord couldn't rent it to anyone else who had a choice. So those kinds of conditions and the license that legal residential segregation gave to landlords to do this created an ecology, created the physical conditions that rats and cockroaches and other pests could use to survive and thrive.
Would you say more about what life was like for people experiencing infestations of these pests?
Sure. I think it's important to recognize that infestation wouldn't be the only environmental condition that was a problem in their homes or their neighborhoods. So if we look at, for example, Baltimore in the 1930s and 40s, not only would people be living with rampant rats, sometimes 200 rats on a city block, they would also be living in homes where they might not have running water. They probably didn't have an indoor toilet, or maybe it was ill-maintained. There might be a privy in their backyard as well. If you think of the cupboards in your kitchen, it's almost taken for granted that those cupboards are going to be closed. They have a solid door on them. Well, in some cases, the doors of people's cupboards were so worn away that it was very easy for rats and cockroaches to move through them. The floorboards and the baseboards didn't fit with one another, so it provided an easy place for roaches and rats to crawl into the kind of interstices of the home to get into the walls and into the basements. So the homes were really honeycombed in a way that allowed pests to move into them and in between them. A block, a city block, could be basically a habitat for this big community of rats, roaches, and other pests.
Would you say a bit about bedbugs and how those affected people?
Yes. So one of the interesting things I found as I was researching my book was that in the 1930s and 40s and earlier than that, there were a lot of instances where people kind of carved up their homes into very small spaces in order to rent out rooms to more and more people. And one of the old documents had a very interesting observation. It said basically just beds everywhere. There were beds throughout the house in almost every room so that the owner of the home could rent out more spaces, or the renter could actually share the rent with more people and defray the cost of living there. And these beds were all habitats for bedbugs. And imagine the very rich source of food. Bedbugs eat human blood. Imagine the very rich source of food that these bedbugs had. Many, many beds for them to nest on, and then many, many bodies sleeping in those beds that the bedbugs could crawl onto and take a meal.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Don Beeler, Assistant Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of the book, Pests in the City, Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What approaches did reformers take to address pest control?
They took a range of approaches, and some of them were more effective than others. If we look at the flies, for instance, I would say we could divide the approaches to fly control into approaches focused on the home itself and then approaches focused on the broader urban environment. And certainly a lot of reformers emphasized the fact that there's a lot of horse manure, that there are open privies at a stage in our history when we could have been installing flush toilets and sewers in every neighborhood. So I think the most progressive reformers wanted to see a whole kind of reform of the entire urban landscape. They wanted to see better sanitation to clean up that horse manure. They wanted to see every single block connected to the sewer, privies removed, flush toilets installed, so you wouldn't have that source of human waste out in the backyard. On the other hand, it turned out that this kind of broad landscape-based approach of cleaning the entire city was very expensive and very difficult. And a lot of reformers weren't willing to put that time and energy and investment into it. And so many reformers ended up recommending that women especially shore up the boundaries of their homes, install window screens, make sure that there are no cracks through which flies could move and enter the home, keep special track of their babies, making sure that no flies landed on their babies or in their baby's food, protect milk especially from the incursion of flies, because milk is a very rich medium for the breeding of these intestinal germs. And so a lot of responsibility in these cases was placed on the mothers and the housewives to protect that sphere of the home. Meanwhile, you've got this incredibly filthy outdoor realm with stables going uncleaned, with streets caked with manure, and old privies sitting in backyards that are creating these enormous populations of flies.
Overall, how successful were the efforts to encourage people to take care of their homes? To what extent did it actually help?
So in many regions of the United States, it became very common to install window screens in one's home. And so it became something, I think, that was internalized by the population, that you put window screens into your windows to protect yourself from whatever threats are outside, whatever insects might come in. It's not common in all parts of the United States, but it became very common across the East Coast and the South to have window screens. So people definitely did take these measures to protect their homes, and there was increasing pressure on women to maintain the home as a healthy space. To take another example of these kind of individualized approaches, the activist Booker T. Washington founded what was called National Negro Health Week, of course using that old-fashioned term for African Americans. And Booker T. Washington urged his followers to adopt these personal, individualized, or community-scale interventions where you would clean up your home. And during this 1 week in April was National Health Week, and people would go out, work with their neighbors, patch up their homes, plant gardens, get rid of rat habitat in their neighborhoods. And so there's a very strong tradition of these kind of self-help activities to get rid of the pests in one's community and to protect these domestic spaces from incursions of rats, cockroaches, and so on.
To what extent was public funding made available for pest control?
It varies a lot, and I think it has to do somewhat with the pest. Now, at first, when it was first discovered that flies might be able to carry these intestinal diseases, there was a little burst of funding to try to address the fly menace in a lot of cities. But there was then this kind of gradual decline where reformers started to see it as more of a personal responsibility. It was seen as a personal responsibility for roaches as well as for bedbugs. But for rats, it's gone back and forth whether it was considered a public responsibility deserving of public funding or a private responsibility. I'll give you an example of this where it sparked a huge debate. In 1967, President Lyndon Johnson proposed a national rat eradication bill or a rat control bill that would have provided federal funding for cities to apply for, where they could use that funding to create comprehensive rat control projects. And one of the most fascinating incidents in the history of urban pest control in the 20th century was what happened the day this came to the floor in Congress. And basically Congress, especially rural members of Congress, laughed the bill off the floor, claiming that the federal government should not take responsibility for basically what they thought of as a minor pest, these rats. This is at a time when rats were biting 14,000 people a year, most of them children, causing a lot of suffering, causing a lot of stress among parents and kids. And it was the same time at which members of Congress were seeking federal funding for more minor pests that had aesthetic problems, that created aesthetic problems, but that didn't have that kind of public health or public safety threat that rats did. So, for example, there was a member of Congress from Ohio who called for federal funding to get rid of starlings and other nuisance birds. Other federally funded programs addressed water hyacinths, which got tangled in the propellers of pleasure boats in southern waterways. These kinds of things got attention and funding, but not so much the rats. Now, eventually, even after this incident in Congress where the bill was introduced and members of Congress laughed it off the floor. Eventually, Lyndon Johnson got it back into a bill, kind of snuck it in the back door and got some federal funding. But there's always been a very strenuous debate about whether there should be public funding and public responsibility for these kinds of pest problems.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Don Beeler, Assistant Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of the book, Pests in the City, Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats. How successful was the use of pesticides in controlling pests in urban environments?
It varied. We've had a lot of different kinds of pesticides, and some of them have worked, and some of them have actually made the problem worse. I think the case in which we've had the most problems has been with the organochloride and the organophosphate pesticides and pests like bedbugs and cockroaches. And it's not even necessarily the pesticides themselves, but the way in which they've been used that's created the greatest problem. In many cases, right after the end of World War II, when pesticides like DDT were introduced, a lot of new pest control operators got into the business, regarded often as very shady by their better-trained counterparts in established businesses. And they'd heard these rumors that this new pesticide, DDT, and some related pesticides like chlordane, lindane, would be very, very easy to use to get rid of cockroaches and bedbugs and other pests. And these folks got into the business with very little training and applied some of these pesticides quite indiscriminately. And the population pressure that came from applying these pesticides actually created more resistant populations of pests like German cockroaches and our common bedbug, who's now come back and is resistant to almost anything we throw at it.
How was the experience of pest control different in more affluent neighborhoods compared to low-income neighborhoods?
Well, that's a great question. So I think part of the issue is the proportion of renters versus homeowners. And in many cases, it is the responsibility of the landlord, if you've got a rental situation, to provide pest control. And also in lower income neighborhoods and in urban areas, you have much more multifamily housing than single family housing. And this means that it's very difficult to kind of contain the pest control issue to one housing unit. In a suburban area or an area where you have predominantly homeowners, it's a bit easier to contain the problem to one unit, especially if these are detached homes. But if you've got attached homes, multiple apartments in one building, or very densely packed buildings, then you have the potential for that pest population to be kind of shared among that whole community or a whole block. That means that if you have just one single pest control operator coming in to perform pest control in one unit, that won't necessarily solve the problem because that pest population is contiguous. And if that housing unit is not completely sound, and it really has to be sound, you can have reinfiltration, repopulation by that pest. So that's one aspect of it. And I would say another aspect of it is that if you're in an urban area, you often have these kind of multiple overlapping jurisdictions of different kinds of agencies, public and private property owners who are maybe providing their own pest control, performing their own pest control, or bringing in contractors to do it. And that might mean that you're actually getting exposed to a lot of different pesticides in any one place because of these overlapping jurisdictions. In the course of your life, you might go through places that have experienced lots of different pesticide applications. It really complicates things to be in an urban area and to be in a low-income area where you have government-owned buildings, perhaps, or private landlords right next to one another.
Would you speak about the use of integrated pest management in low-income housing?
Yes, so that's been a really promising development over the past 20 years, and it's important to think about the I in integrated pest management. what are all the things that you integrate? It's important, of course, to integrate different methods of pest control, methods that address the structure of the building, methods that address any food sources or water sources for the pests, and perhaps, if you don't have any alternative, using some low toxicity chemicals to address the pests that live there. But I think there's another important thing to integrate beyond just the pests' food and their habitat and any possible need for chemical solutions. You also really need to integrate with that empowerment of the people who live there. And if you don't integrate the residents, the people who perhaps have been suffering with pest problems for years and years, then you won't be able to sustain that pest control, the good pest management that can be established with a new integrated pest management project. A great example of this actually happened in Chicago in the 1990s when a group of women residents of a public housing project demanded that the building, the project, be renovated in a way that was pest-free. And the residents of the building actually got involved in doing some of the physical work and also training their neighbors to maintain their homes in a pest-free condition. And it really gave them, this whole arrangement gave them an upper hand so that they could demand clean, healthy environmental conditions for themselves and for their families.
What have been some additional grassroots efforts to address pest infestations in the urban environment?
A lot of the grassroots efforts to perform pest control in lower-income housing have been associated with activism around housing itself. So at the same time as people were trying to demand a better housing environment, they were also demanding better choices in housing. And especially for civil rights activists and African Americans, there was a big push to integrate these kind of housing quality issues with desegregation of housing. So for example, in the 1950s, there was a bill in New York City to abolish housing discrimination by race. And that was seen by many civil rights activists at the time as rat control. So there were actually newspaper articles that called this bill the rat control bill, because there had been so many children in these segregated neighborhoods such as Harlem who suffered rat bites. And many believed that if you desegregated housing, you would have an evening out of the quality of housing, that the housing available to African Americans would rise in quality. Landlords could no longer leave the homes for African Americans to decline. And then you would not have the rats and the other problems that so many African Americans in neighborhoods like Harlem were suffering with. So that's a very good example of how civil rights and housing activism and pest control all kind of wrapped up together.
Bed bugs largely disappeared from the U.S., but now have returned. Why has this happened?
Well, there are a lot of theories out there about why it's happened, and a lot of them do have to do with the fact that there's been an evolution of pesticide resistance. There's also the issue of how we've been doing pest control. When bed bugs originally disappeared, these pesticides were being applied kind of often on a regular basis. And sometimes, even if people weren't trying to get rid of bed bugs, even if they didn't have them, they were actually kind of creating a protective barrier around their homes that got rid of bed bugs. And that worked for a time. But our pest control methods have evolved. They've become much safer, which is a good thing. But we no longer use these residual methods that used to get rid of bed bugs. Some people respond to this knowledge by saying, well, we need to bring back DDT, we need to bring back some of these organochloride pesticides that were popular in the middle of the 20th century. The trouble with that is we have very, very few of those chemicals left that bed bugs are not resistant to. In other words, the populations of bed bugs that we have in the wild now are bed bugs that don't respond to the pesticides the way their ancestors did. There's a very high degree of resistance in those populations. So what's the answer? I think a lot of the answer is to remove the stigma to having bed bugs, to help the people who have a bed bug problem come out into the open, get help for their problem, to make the environment of housing more sound, and to give people some of these integrated pest management kind of tools for dealing with bed bugs, for getting rid of the clutter in their homes, and also having their landlords take good care of the homes that they're living in, so there aren't many harborage places, aren't many places for those bed bugs to hide.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope that it will get us to think about homes as an environment. And I hope that it will help us understand that we've known about pests and pest problems for over a century now, and yet we haven't changed our housing and we haven't changed our cities in a holistic and socially just way that will get rid of them. And this is why we continue to live with pests. We continue to live with pests because we still have similar social injustices and similar inattention to quality of housing as we had in the early 20th century.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I want people to think about their homes as an ecosystem, and also think about your cities as an ecosystem. Even if you aren't encountering problems with pests, chances are there's someone somewhere else in the city where you live who is. And ask questions. Why are they experiencing those problems? What kind of policies do we have in place about housing, health codes, things like that, that might leave them in a condition where they have to live with pests every day?
Well, thanks so much for being here, Dawn.
Thanks for talking with me, Diane.
You were just listening to Dawn Beeler, Assistant Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of the book, Pests in the City, Flies, Bedbugs, Cockroaches, and Rats, published in 2013 by the University of Washington Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.